Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Matthias Cormann is about to be the minister who secures a major change in the Senate voting system. There's a dash of chance in this. He's become Special Minister of State in addition to his Finance Minister job after the former minister, Mal Brough, quit the front bench because he's subject of a police investigation. The government has done a deal with the Greens which will enable a basic change to the system. In future, there will be optional preferential voting which will replace the present group tickets for those who vote above the line. And in a last-minute change, as the bill is going through Parliament, this will apply to below-the-line voters as well. The new system will better reflect voters' wishes than the present arrangements, but it will also squeeze out micro players, whether micro parties or individuals. So we won't be getting the Ricky Muirs in the future. Matthias Cormann, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
You've made a last minute change to the Senate reform bill. Can you explain what you've done?
Well, the announcement that we made today, responding to the recommendations of the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters into our Senate voting reform proposal, is that as well as introducing optional preferential voting above the line, we are proposing to introduce a form of optional preferential voting below the line as well, which is broadly consistent with the original recommendations of this committee. And the way we would propose to do so is that there will be guidance on the Senate ballot paper instructing voters to vote below the line by numbering boxes 1 to 12 in order of their preference, and there will be a savings provision to ensure that any ballot paper where at least six boxes are numbered from 1 to 6 below the line, that vote would still be considered formal.
Now, this was in the original recommendation of that committee a couple of years ago. Why wasn't it taken up in your bill initially?
Well, obviously what we sought to do and our priority in our reform proposal as originally proposed was to empower voters to determine what happens with their preferences after their vote one above the line. The problem at the moment is that if you vote one above the line, you lose control of what happens to your preferences to group voting ticket arrangements negotiated by backroom operators in political parties. The same problem doesn't exist below the line. Above the line, it is not possible for voters to express a preference and to determine what happens to their preferences. Below the line, right now, voters can express a preference and direct their preferences according to their wishes. So our initial view, based on consultation on the original Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters report, was that the priority was to abolish group and individual voting tickets, to give voters the power to determine preferences above the line, and to make a slight improvement to the savings provision below the line, which would have led to less than 1% of informal votes based on the results at the last election. But, you know, on reflection, and this is the parliamentary process at work, having considered the submissions that were made by very distinguished Australians to the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters, having considered the recommendations of that committee to put forward this opportunity for below the line voting as well, we have made a decision to go along with that recommendation.
Now, that inquiry was a very short one. As you say, you got lots of submissions, but only half a day of hearings, and that was yesterday. Report was out first thing this morning. Do you think, in retrospect, it would have been better to bring this legislation forward earlier in the term? Obviously, it was delayed, so you didn't upset the crossbenchers too much, but they were always going to be upset when it happened.
Well, so I don't agree with your characterisation. Obviously, the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters started this process some years ago, indeed very soon after the 2013 election. That committee considered the conduct of the last election, in particular the conduct of the Senate election, made a series of recommendations which the government has been considering and which the government has been consulting on with interested parties in the parliament. And we acted on this and put forward our proposal when we were ready to do so, given what was happening with those discussions. Now, when this is not a complicated reform proposal, what the government is seeking to do is to ensure that in future elections, the result of the Senate election reflects the will of the people. And the way we're proposing to do that is by empowering voters to determine what they want to happen to their preferences above the line as well as below the line. And that is something that has been recommended by a cross-party committee of the parliament, including with the support of Labour, the Greens, the coalition, for many, many years. The suggestion by some that this is rushed is just part of political games being played now, given that Labour has changed their position at the last minute.
What do you say to the critics who argue that this will stifle the rise of serious small parties, that this really puts a corset on the system, if you like?
Well, it doesn't. What it does is it empowers the Australian people to determine what happens to their votes and to their preferences. What it does is it will help ensure that the result at the next Senate election, at any subsequent Senate election, reflects the will of the people. Now, what the makeup of the next Senate is, what the result is at the next election, is a matter for the Australian people. Our job as members of Parliament now considering this issue is to ensure that the electoral process helps deliver a result which genuinely reflects the will of the Australian people. And that is what we're doing, based on the recommendations some years ago put forward by a cross-party committee of the Parliament with unanimous recommendations. And incidentally, it wasn't just Labour's Shadow Minister Gary Gray that endorsed that approach and indeed was a strong advocate for what we're proposing. Senator John Faulkner was part of this. The then Senator John Faulkner was part of this inquiry. Obviously, the deputy chair of that inquiry is a Labour member of Parliament, long-serving Labour member of Parliament in Alan Griffin. All of them supported and advocated for this position. And indeed, the National Secretary of the Labour Party advocated for what we are now proposing to do in his submission to this inquiry some 2 years ago. So, Bill Shorten just was put under pressure by some of his discredited backroom operators, and he has succumbed to that pressure instead of taking the advice, the considered advice of highly regarded long-serving members of Parliament like his shadow minister Gary Gray.
Now, as one of the main negotiators for the coalition in the Senate, you've had more to do with the crossbench senators than many people. You're a man of considerable patience, but what has it been like? Has it been a really frustrating job to have to do that?
Not at all. I mean, I've enjoyed my engagement with the crossbench, and every day when I come into this office and do this job, I give it the best I can on behalf of Australia, and I have enjoyed working with crossbench members of Parliament. But
I thought you were going to say you would invite one or two in for breakfast.
I've had regular meetings with a number of crossbench senators for some time now. But the point here, though, is that if you look at the public interest in relation to elections, it is in the public interest for the result of an election to reflect the will of the Australian people. At the last election, 97% of Australian voters voted above the line in the Senate. Those 97% of Australian voters voting above the line immediately lost control of their preferences after they put the number one into that box above the line. What we are enabling them to do is to determine where their preferences go, instead of having the Stephen Conroys and the Sam Dastyaris of this world trade and direct those preferences and in exchange and in return for favours for other political parties. So this is about making sure that the Australian people are empowered to determine what they want to happen with their vote and with their preferences and who they ultimately help to elect into the Senate.
As you say, we don't know how an election will go, the next Senate election will go, what sort of result it will produce. But it was interesting this week that John Howard said that the principal winners, he thought in future, would be the Greens. And he sort of said it in a way that he hoped this had been thought through, he was suggesting. If the Greens do end up the long-term principal winners, won't it be more difficult for a future coalition government to try and deal with one block that's ideologically hostile than a range of people who are all over the place?
Well, I'm not a speculator, and my job is not to speculate on what the Australian people may or may not decide down the track. The result at the next election and any election after that is entirely a matter for the Australian people. Our job as public policymakers, as we consider the most appropriate process to facilitate elections into the future, is to ensure that that process delivers the result that the Australian people intended to deliver, that the election result in the Senate and indeed in the Parliament reflects the will of the Australian people. And that is what we are working to do. And we are grateful that other senators and other parties in the Senate have agreed with the government on these matters.
Now you're about to get this change through. Wouldn't it be foolish not to go to a double dissolution and get a Senate that reflected the will of the people better?
These matters are not related. The truth is that whenever the election is and whatever the form of that election, from a public interest point of view, it is important that that election result reflects the will of the Australian people. When it comes to double dissolution elections, there's obviously a lot of speculation. Our intention is to serve until in the ordinary course of events until an election which is due in August, September, October this year. Double dissolution elections are options available to government under our constitution at any time, irrespective of what happens to this legislation, to resolve deadlocks between the House of Representatives and the Senate. Now, the two are not linked.
Except that this government has been complaining for a very long time that the Senate has not acted responsibly in many cases. So,
what we've complained about is that the Labor Party has not acted responsibly. I mean, if the Labor Party had acted responsibly, we would have been able to get all of our legislation through the Senate.
And if the crossbenchers had been more amenable, you would have too.
Well, the blame here is very much on Bill Shorten and the Labor Party. Bill Shorten and the Labor Party left our budget in a mess. They burdened our economy with lead in our saddlebag, things like the carbon tax and the mining tax, which were bad for jobs and investment and bad for economic growth. And they have fought us every step of the way as we've worked to put Australia on a stronger economic and fiscal foundation for the future. It was their responsibility, having created the fiscal and economic challenges for our country at the worst possible time, arguably, given what was happening in the global economy. It was their responsibility as the alternative party of government to work with us to put Australia on the strongest possible economic and fiscal foundation for the future.
Now, just turning then to budgetary matters, it's a particularly busy time, obviously, for economic ministers. The budget's being prepared, the tax changes are being crafted. Now, I know you've made the point this week that they're mainly the Treasurer's responsibility, but all the economic ministers are in that mix. It now seems that the tax package is going to be much more modest than had been first expected. Is there a risk that if it's much more modest, or when it's much more modest, we miss a once-in-a-generation chance to get major tax reform?
Well, I let the commentators and the analysts make judgments on what their assessment is of our tax policy package when it is released by the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, but let me make this broader point. As a government, ever since our election in September 2013, we've been working very hard to strengthen growth, create more jobs, and to pursue and implement our plan for stronger growth and more jobs. Now, that has involved making our tax system more growth-friendly. That's why we got rid of the mining tax and the carbon tax. That's why we delivered tax cuts for small business in the last budget, and that is why we are looking at further opportunities to make our tax system more growth-friendly. But that is also why we've pursued an ambitious deregulation agenda, an ambitious infrastructure investment agenda, an ambitious free trade agenda, an ambitious innovation agenda. That is why we're pursuing media reform, Senate reform. I mean, so we are dealing with all of the big issues, and tax is one of these very important issues. And obviously, as we usually do in the context of the budget, there will be a series of announcements on what the government's intentions are moving forward.
We are hearing a lot from the backbench on tax and on spending. Do you think that this is a useful reality check coming from the electorate, or does it in fact inhibit making major reforms?
It is a very important part of our democratic process, of course. I mean, as a government, we engage always with our backbench, and indeed we work through the issues and through all of the different options in front of us in an orderly and methodical fashion within the team. I mean, you know, there's a level of conversation, of course, within the cabinet, as you'd expect, and there is a level of conversation with our party room, which is appropriate and necessary. And that is what contributes to good and strong and sound decision making.
Well, this conversation is particularly focusing in some cases on spending cuts. We heard from Tony Abbott yesterday that there should be a tough approach on spending. Does seem, though, a big ask before an election to say that spending should be looked at again in a major way.
Well, we have never stopped looking at the spending side of the budget. When we came into government in 2013, we inherited a rapidly deteriorating budget position, principally because of a unsustainable and unfunded spending growth trajectory that had been locked in by the previous government, in particular in the period beyond the published forward estimates at the time, that is beyond the period that the previous government was going to be the government. And we have been working our way through that. We've made significant progress in the period of the Abbott government. We're building on that progress in the period of the Turnbull government. We've already made very clear that the fiscal discipline that we are imposing ourselves in the lead up to this budget, I mean, but this is an ongoing process. We have to at all times ensure that we only spend as much as necessary, as little as possible, that we spend taxpayers' money wisely, as efficiently and as effectively as possible. And of course, you know, that is necessary for us to ensure that we can limit the money that we have to raise out of the community by way of taxes in a way that means that taxes can be as low as possible while also being as efficient and as the least distorting the economy possible.
Is there a lot of fat left on the spending side, though?
Well, the job to ensure that spending is as low as possible, as well targeted as possible, as high as necessary but as low as possible, as efficient and as effective as possible, continues. And we certainly inherited a very challenging and a very negative trajectory from the previous government. We've done a lot of work to get on top of that, and we're heading in the right direction now, and we've made progress heading in the right direction, but there is more work to be done, and the specifics, of course, will be announced in the budget.
Can you just clarify, though, as we go into this budget, whether on the spending side it's a matter of a new fresh assault or whether it's a matter of housekeeping, offsetting new programs, just making sure that there are nips and tucks where you can?
Well, in any budget, you have a comprehensive look at the spending side of your budget, you have a comprehensive look at the revenue side of your budget, you have a look at where the opportunities are to ensure that you spend as much as necessary, but not more, that you spend as little as possible, that you spend it as wisely and as effectively and as efficiently as possible, and that you, you know, raise the revenue in the best possible way. And that is a process that is currently underway, as it is in the lead-up to any and every budget.
Just finally, as Finance Minister, you're the government's nuts and bolts money man. Now, we don't know whether there'll be a double dissolution, but we do know that if the government went down that road, timing is very tight. The budget's May 10, the last day for announcing such an election is May 11. We also know you have to have supply to get through a double dissolution. Can you just tell me the mechanism for getting supply in such circumstances?
There are a lot of hypotheticals and a lot of ifs in that question. I don't know what the precise timing of the election is going to be. You know, if there was such a decision down the track, we would cross that bridge at that time.
But you must have done a bit of work ahead of time.
You know, from where I sit, our intention is to go to the election in August, September, October. If that were to change, and that is, of course, entirely a matter for the Prime Minister to make a judgment in the national interest on the timing and the form of the election, obviously you'd expect that all of the necessary work would be done if that is required at that point in time.
Matthias Kuhlmann, thank you very much for talking with us again. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for today. We'll be back with another interview soon. Thanks very much.